to Regenerative Mindset. In this podcast, we'll explore fresh ideas and inspiring stories from trusted voices who share practical wisdom on bringing positive change to our lives, our society, and our world. I'm your host, Stacey Pollice. As a psychologist, regenerative farmer, and climate activist, I've developed a deep curiosity for thriving ecosystems. Whether it's on my avocado ranch in Southern California or in the ways we engage with each other. Join me as I chat with brilliant guests who challenge our thinking and expand our understanding of how we can live more sustainably, healthfully, and regeneratively, to give back more than we take. Together, we'll see how personal healing can create a ripple effect that reaches our communities and even the earth beneath our feet. So let's get curious together. In this very special episode, I sit down with my favorite 97-year-old, Hugh Warnock, otherwise known as my dad. Offering his unique optimistic insights from a long and remarkable life, he tells us some of the stories that have shaped his values and soul's purpose. He talks about a lifelong connection to the Sierra Nevada mountains and how sailing on the Pacific Ocean provided deep spiritual connection and meaning. He reflects on his early years growing up in a large family in Los Angeles, running away from home with his dog, Boy, and his enduring love for his three daughters. As an adolescent, Hugh went from being chronically ill to finding peak health when he discovered that food was medicine, an idea that has had a profound impact on my own path. He opens up about his life-changing decision to quit drinking alcohol at age 50, and the secrets behind a successful marriage spanning nearly 70 years. Join us for this intimate conversation as my father and I explore nature, resilience, wisdom, and the life lessons he's gathered along the way. Hi, Dad. How are you today?
I'm fair to middling.
We'll take it. We'll take it. You're very close to 97 years old at this point, and your wisdom seems to just be bubbling over every time we hang out. Your grandson, Will, is the one who said, "Why don't you interview Grandpa? That could be really interesting." And I thought, great idea. So thanks for joining today, Dad. My first question for you today is, I find you to have a very buoyant, optimistic personality and outlook. That's my experience of you. You've always been a go-getter and you're willing and you seem optimistic. I'm wondering, is there anything that you would credit with that? Or do you think you were born this way?
Well, number one, at some point, I look back and I see I used to blow my world up in my mind and see myself in it and try to determine what is it I have to say or what do I want to know. And I sort of progressed from there.
That's very interesting. I've never heard that before. When you say blow it up, do you mean magnify it so that you can see more clearly?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's like when you do this sort of conversational thing with these electronic machines, it can make your voice louder. It can make, you know, it can be more resounding. And I have a better chance of understanding what you have to say and what somebody else has to say.
Right. Well, okay. So one of the things that I think have been a big influence for you are the Sierra Nevada mountains. You have told me that's your church.
Yes. I love the Sierra. There were times when I would stop and literally meditate while I was out in the fields, in the Sierras. I love the Sierras, the silence and the scenery. And it just would transmit to me the beauty of the land that I was in. And it was so unusual and so unique. And I wanted to be sure I saw as much of it as I could.
Yeah, and you made it a priority throughout your life. I know that. You went every year.
I just felt it was my job to get to know the Sierras as best way I could. And that was a personal thing I had. I loved the Sierras. I loved the wind, the sounds, the air, everything about it. And I studied it, not as a usual study, but just being super conscious of where I was and what I was doing.
Well, I think of you as being highly intuitive and highly spiritual. And that's, to me, what I'm hearing you say right now. It feels like it's in the realm of spirituality. Would you say that? So there's a way in which majestic nature is a spiritual experience for you?
Yes, I would say that's correct.
Now, I don't know about what you would say, but at the time that you were coming up as a young person, you were born when? 1928. So that makes you're very soon to turn 97 years old. But at that time, was a quality of sensitivity or spirituality common in men? I mean, I think of John Muir, and he waxed poetic. And I know you love poetry. And was that ever a conflict for you to have that high level of sensitivity and spirituality? Or no, not really?
No, not really. It's right.
God bless. It just came natural and you didn't even question it.
Yeah, I don't know what I'm doing. I just like it.
Great. So you didn't worry about what someone else might think of it. Well, now I know you came from a big family in Los Angeles and really kind of a close-knit, kind of a rambunctious group, I would say.
Three girls and three boys.
Right. And where did you fall?
I was five.
Number five. Yeah, right. How has family played a role in your life?
Family's always been foremost in my life. It's always there. I think of my family and I think of who they are, and I respect them so much, so heavily, that they're goddesses and gods to me. That sounds silly, but...
Not here, not to me.
It's a true thing. I think of my brothers, and I appreciate their very thoughts and their feelings. I have a great family. My older brother was 10 years older than me, so that was quite a gap, especially in the young years.
And then came your three sisters, and I know you were close to them as well. You were equally close to the sisters as the brothers.
In my early life, I didn't know my sisters as well as I did when I got kind of into my teens. And then I really felt close to Becky, which was the middle one, Joni, which was the young one, and Nancy was the eldest. Nancy was maybe 9 years or something older than me. I didn't have a whole lot of things in my life that would travel into her life. So I never was too close to Nancy. But Becky and I formed a situation between us where we'd go out just to the store even, and we would start talking about world problems, world events, and people and things, and it was wonderful. I really had a great time. Becky was my favorite in terms of going somewhere and having a fun time talking.
She was an intellectual and she had a great sense of humor.
She did. She is not much a redheaded gal. She was really good. And Joan, the youngest one, I was fairly close to Joan. We were age-wise a little closer.
I thought you were an amazing girl dad. You know, they call it a girl dad. You ended up with three daughters, right? And I'm number two, so I try harder.
Yeah.
But I always felt that you treated me like a person first, not boy or girl. I felt always seen and respected. Yeah. And that's maybe a little bit unique. I have a lot of women friends that didn't have that relationship with their father. So I realize how lucky I am. But it makes me wonder, like, did you wish you had a son? Or I know I was a big tomboy when I was younger. Did you get that fulfilled by me being a big tomboy? Or did us three girls satisfy? Or... And what I would say is you gave me a football for Christmas when I was eight, and you taught me to sail, and you and I were running partners, and you taught me a lot of things that if we'd had a son in the family, I might not have gotten that. But I really appreciated you treating me kind of in a gender neutral way. Like I was just a person. So it was interesting.
Well, I respected you highly for your intelligence and your personality. You really fit my idea of a fine young lady.
Aw. Thanks, Dad. You had what I would call a health and nutrition journey as a young person. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, yeah, I was probably 3 years old, two, three, four. I was sick a lot. I was sick all the time. I missed a lot of school because that was grammar school and there wasn't that much to know or miss. But yeah, so.
Well, I remember that the story went that when you were like in junior high, you grew a foot. In a year, you became 6'2" by the age of like 12, but you were very sickly and thin. But your mother found a special doctor that helped you. Do you remember that story about that special doctor who helped you regain your health?
Vaguely, I do.
Okay, let me give you a hint. Dr. Beeler.
Yeah, Beeler. That's right. Dr. Beeler. He worked up a diet for me, and I lived on a diet. I was underweight. I was skinny, and, you know, I just was...
You got sick a lot.
Yeah, I was sick a lot. But he got me on a diet of everything morning, noon, and night, and I progressed on that diet. And I got to like the diet, and I continued it until I was in my 20s. I can't say that I still do it, but I pretty much have a tendency to go to bran muffins.
Well, and also one of the keys was something that he called Beeler soup.
Yeah, Beeler soup. I didn't get into making that so much, but
I'm going to argue with you. You used to make Beeler soup. You got me on it. And what it is zucchini, green beans, and parsley put in a pot of brought to a boil water, put the lid on, turn the heat off, and then blend it and have a cup in the morning, cup in the evening. And that was one of the cornerstones of Dr. Beeler's healing cure. Like he healed you with food. And I don't know if you remember the name of his book.
No.
Food is Your Best Medicine.
Oh, yeah. Food is Your Best Medicine. Dr. Beeler was a big item in my life. I was very studious about what I ate, and I didn't deviate. I didn't eat any ice cream or, you know, like most kids are nuts for ice cream and cake and all kinds of stuff like that. Sweets.
Yeah, we didn't have any junk food when I was growing up. It definitely impacted my life because you brought those principles to the way you raised us. And I know mom felt the same way. Her mother had focused on whole foods. That was her emphasis. And so I didn't stand a chance. So it's become part of my understanding and it's part of my whole philosophy now. How we grow our food, we grow it healthy to help humans be healthy and create, you know, this cycle of health in our world.
I had a very strong vision of myself as being a healthy individual. I attributed that to my diet, the food that I ate. I did not eat things that most kids would eat, you know, they'd eat the normal meals, but I always had a special meal. It was always vegetables, not too much meat. I had a regimen of what I ate, and it was good for me, and I kept that regimen, although I still do to a certain extent.
I remember raw cashews, like a handful of cashews and a banana and an apple. I mean, not anything that tricky, just whole foods is what I'm thinking. Yeah. Now, here's another subject is you gave up drinking alcohol at a certain point in your life. And I don't remember how old you were, but I'm curious to know for anybody else that might be thinking about that. Right now, there's a lot of research talking about whether alcohol is good for you or not. But what did that do for you? And how did you do that? And what did that mean for you? Can you say anything?
That's interesting you should bring that up because alcohol and drinking was a social thing. And that's where I got into it in that regard. A young person, 12, 13, 14, in a minor way, and I slowly progressed up to the point where it was getting a hold of me. It was governing what I did, what I do, and what I thought. And so I decided was the wrong thing for me to be doing. But that took, I think, until I was about 27 to realize that, 27 years old. And then I finally had threw out most of the junk that I was eating, but not all of it. When I was about 49 years old, 50, I decided no more. I quit, no alcohol. I figured there was no truth to it, no value to it. There was no need for it. And I didn't need it, and it wasn't doing me any good. So I, instead of having the party and having drinks and all that, I'd drink sodas and whatever else. I gave up alcohol, which I'm glad I did because it appealed to me. I mean, you know, it kind of like it's a drug. It loosens you up and you feel like a different person in a sense. But then you make a fool out of yourself too.
Yeah, some people do. And I remember you saying you thought you were allergic. Maybe you had an allergy and maybe some people do have an allergy. And it's part of our culture to participate, but some people it doesn't affect as well as others. So I just always thought it was interesting that you made that choice.
Well, I finally came to the point, the thing, why am I doing this? I don't feel good. I'm not enjoying life while I'm drinking. I'm drinking, I'm a different person. You know, I'm sort of like running on a different fuel.
Well, that takes a certain degree of inner awareness. You know, you have to be tuned into how you feel in order to actually pick up on that.
Yeah, definitely. And that's what I was doing. And that's why I stopped. I just stopped. Bang.
I know, which is so unusual. No props, no AA, no nothing. One day you're like, I'm done.
Well, I knew that it wasn't good for me. I had enough problems, not really serious problems, but with my eyes and, you know, and just general health condition. I figured, why am I doing this?
Well, I think it's exemplary and interesting and worth sharing. So you are one of the lucky people in that the woman that you fell in love with and who has been your life partner by your side for almost 70, I mean, going on 70 years here. What do you think the secret to a long marriage or a long partnership could be with your beloved Smead? You call her Smead. I still am not clear why.
The word Smead was part of a television show. And I can't remember now the character, the man, who was a famous comic guy. He used that term. I just liked the idea. So I started calling Lou Smead.
Well, so what do you credit your long and good relationship with Mom? I see you guys holding hands, saying, I love you. So beautiful. You're an example to so many people. What do you credit a long relationship? What are some tips, Dad?
Well, number one, I was interested in what she did, what work she was in, and the things that she was involved with. I found her very interesting and educated, and I just felt very comfortable around her, and that was enough for me. I just loved her, and that was it. And it wasn't any tumultuous thing. I knew what I wanted, and that was what I wanted, and finally came down to inviting her to be my wife. And that was a grand decision that I had to make on my own. And I had to present to her.
And thank God she said yes.
Yeah. Well, boy, you're not kidding. Yeah. Thank goodness, because she's a wonderful human being.
And you guys share one of the things I notice over the years is a really great sense of humor. I feel like you guys over the years laugh a lot.
Yeah, well, it's important because I was kind of a rambunctious character. And I would do things that I thought were funny, and she would laugh too. And you're right, she has a good sense of humor.
Yeah, it's good. And I watch you guys to see, you know, wow, how do you stay with someone for almost 70 years? And that's, wow, that's an example.
Well, yeah, we don't hide anything from each other. Everything's on the table. And if we dislike something or somebody or whatever, I feel safe in discussing it with her. We've never had head-on battle, never. If we ever had an argument or anything that caused us to be mad at each other.
Well, within reason, let's be real.
Well, yeah, occasionally.
Yeah, I mean, the point is it never created such a rift. So you can disagree. Okay, so like, for instance, as I can see by the visor you're wearing, you went to USC. Mom went to UCLA, and that was a bit contested watching those Rose Bowl games in the 1960s. I remember it was tough stuff if USC did not win. But you guys had differences. You guys had different political parties for a number of years. I mean, you didn't agree on everything. And today, having a married couple with different political parties or different football teams or whatever, it's like that can be tension causing. And yet you guys did it pretty well, I thought.
I appreciated lose school, UCLA, which is a direct opposite from USC. And those two schools were in Los Angeles are rivals.
Yes, crosstown rivals.
Crosstown rivals. And that was no question about it. But with her, it never entered my mind.
You guys used to joke about it. She'd call it University of Second Choice. And then you had some, you know, USC is the University of Second Choice back in the day. And then you had some jokes about those spunky little Bruins or whatever. You guys used to tease about it back in the day. Yeah. Well, that's been a really good example, I think. And it's something that a lot of us could learn from.
It is, because a lot of people can carry that too far. They can be so enamored by the school or whatever it happens to be, so into it. I mean, they don't want to consider anything else. But UCLA to me was an opposite end of the stick. I mean, I didn't think much of UCLA at all, but I just kept my mouth shut.
And it was more about the person, not about their affiliation. I think separating the human being from the affiliation, whatever team or whatever school or whatever political party, it's not about that. You can keep that to yourself. So you were able to separate that.
Yeah, that's right.
Interesting. Good. Okay, those are words to live by right now.
When you start thinking that way, you know, you don't particularly like something, but you can go ahead and go through it and work with it. And then you neutralize your opinions in yourself so that you're injecting the other people's ideas and thoughts and actions. And it has a tendency to form an opinion in you that is agreeable to forming a like for something that you originally didn't like. You know, I mean, like with UCLA, I just had a negative attitude towards UCLA for many years, probably because my brothers and sisters all went to USC. And the fact is, I joined the United States Army basically so I could go to USC, because it was a costly school, and I was not that close to my father that I could ask him to pay tuition to some school, probably $1,000 or something. I don't know what it was.
Back in the day, it was a lot, though. But so, ironically, you marry a crosstown rival who you adore. So it's more about the person, not the team.
Lucille was always Lucille. She never was UCLA.
I like that. Yeah, she's her. Doesn't matter what her political party is or her team. Yeah.
She believes in something. I respect that.
Beautiful, Dad. Well, now I want to ask you about athletics, because I feel that once you came back to health, as we discussed about your diet really helped you become healthy, you became an athlete. What exactly did you do, let's say, in high school? I think that was when you really became healthy and athletic.
It started, well, let's see, high school.
Hamilton High. I just want to put a plug for Hammy High in Los Angeles.
But it started before that, Louis Pasteur Junior High School. It was about, I don't know how many, might have been 6 or 7 miles. And I had to walk that to Louis Pasteur, which was the junior high school. And I got into doing a little bit of athletics with that school at that point, and as minor. Then I went from that junior high school to Hamilton High School, which had a real football team and a track team. And I, you know, my eyes opened and got real big, and I signed up for both of them. And I wound up being the captain of the football team at one point. And I was probably the third fastest hurdler in Los Angeles at that time in the high hurdles. But I got really into athletics pretty soundly through high school and in college. And I really developed an interest in that.
Yeah, that was important. We still have your Letterman sweater from high school. It was a big deal. Well, and I feel like you've kept athletics, some form of physical activity has been a constant for you. And I wonder if you credit your longevity partially to staying active.
Oh, absolutely. Fact is, if you're in sports and if you have intentions of being good at it, which I did, I had intentions, played right in for high school, you needed to be completely convinced that that's what you wanted to do. And in order to do that, you couldn't disobey the order of things with your body. You couldn't drink alcohol. You didn't smoke. I mean, I did smoke at one point.
In the Army.
Yeah, it got to two packs a day.
But you came out of it, and I know as a kid, exercise and sports and all of it has always so important to the way you thought it was valuable to be a healthy human.
I still do. I think it's very important. It's a combination. It helps you in your life. It keeps you strong, keeps you mentally active and competitive. You know, it's a good thing. Sports is a good thing to be involved with.
Well, and also, like, you stayed going to the gym forever. And now what I see in the elderly years, shall we call them, the ability to stand up and sit down, you know, those hip muscles and the thigh muscles. Boy, does that matter. So you were right.
The ability to keep your body capable of handling life situations is important. I came across that realization early on. In order to really enjoy life, all the things, the various things you can do, if you have an athletic background, it's a valuable asset. And I believe that, and I still believe it. Even if, you know, like I chose track, high hurdles. I was a good high hurdler. I was fast. I was about the third fastest in LA.
I did not inherit your fast twitch muscles. I remember you marching me out to a track meet and you're like, let's enter this race. And I was like pulling up the rear and you put me in every single event until we found something I was good at. And I don't know if you remember, but guess what? I was this spindly little, tall, spindly junior high girl. I ended up being really good at shot put and discus. I went to the state with shot put. That's something I don't put on my resume, but just thought I'd mention it here. And it was because of you. You marched me around until we found something I was good at.
Because I was so sickly as a child, it really, really was important for me to build myself up, to be able to be a normal human being and be able to do the things that I wanted to do. And the way to do that was through sports. And I really believed it all the way from grammar school, junior high school. I would go out and I'd run around the track and walk to school 10 miles.
Wait, the miles just got longer. At first it was 6 or 7, now it's 10. Next thing, it's going to be in knee-high snow in West Los Angeles in a minute. If we're not, I caught you there exaggerating.
And I normally catch myself.
It's hyperbole. It tells a good story, which you're a good storyteller. I want you to talk a little bit about, you taught me to sail at a young age. And when I was about 4 or 5, you built a boat of your very own. And you went on to race that boat until you won the national championship. And then you bought another boat. And we raced that for years together, as well as you taught my cousin Jay how to sail. And he went on to become an Olympic medalist. He won a silver. And you initially taught Jay how to sail. So where did you learn about sailing? What drove you from such a young age?
I don't know what the basic drive was, but I must have thought sailing was an interesting thing. But when I started thinking about it, I started buying magazines, sailing magazines, and I got involved in what kind of boats were available and what there was available to do. And then I finally decided on an English boat, and I can't remember what the name of it was.
It was an Enterprise.
Yeah, the Enterprise. I started taking magazines, like a sailing magazine. They'd have advertisements in there. And then there was one from this English firm selling, what'd you call it?
Well, an Enterprise, it was a wooden kit boat. So they sent you the materials, and then you created a workshop in the garage, and over a period of time, you built a boat.
I sent away to England, I think it was $400 for this boat, and reading a magazine, and I finally decided I want to do this. I did. $400, and by golly, I got a call from the harbor. Your ship has come in. I went down there and got this big box of all the parts. Some of them were formed, like the stern panel was formed, but the panels for the sides and stringers that held things together.
But sailing was a huge part of your life, and it was a big part of mine as well. I remember I crewed for you on that Enterprise when I was little, and then we got a sabbat, and you used to march me down, and it's like, you're going to sail on a Saturday morning. I'm like, no, I want to play with my friends. And you're like, no, believe me, you won't regret it. And I'd get out there, and you'd coach me from the sidelines with your megaphone. And by golly, I did learn.
You learn by doing. That's what I did. I learned by doing. I didn't know anything about sailing. I imported that kit boat from England, this big box of pieces of wood, brought it home in the garage, and spent weeks, building this boat. And it was a beautiful boat. Enterprise. Yeah, I was super excited about that whole deal.
So, Dad, I know how you got into having a boat and sailing, but what was it about sailing that you loved? Like, remembering back how many hours you spent on the water, and you and I got to have a lot of time on the water, but what did you love about the ocean?
You never knew what was ahead of you. You had to adjust yourself to the conditions that you met as you went along in the water.
Well, you used to say to me, you have to respect the sea.
Yes, you must respect the sea. It's massive and it's very, very complicated. So you have to be open for suggestions from the sea as to what to do next. And you should be listening because it's speaking and you better be listening.
That's interesting. Well, we spent a lot of time together racing boats on the sea.
That was on a calm sea.
Well, sometimes not so calm. I remember one time having a breach, I think you'd call it, where we had the spinnaker up, we came around an oil island and whammo.
Yeah, that's a little tough when you got the spinnaker up and the seas get rough.
but it was exciting. I'll describe a couple things I loved about it. One, I got to be with you and we got to work together and we had a team. There was, what, about five of us? It was a group of men and me, and we all came together every week to do something.
Yeah, that was wonderful. Something I'll never forget.
And then our class of boats, the same people would come out every week. And so we knew them, they knew us, and we would be competing. And something you used to talk about is the Corinthian spirit. And that made a difference in how one behaved, because you can get away with things at sea, but you're like, no, you have to maintain a Corinthian spirit. It's like you have to have high integrity, because no one else can see what you're doing at sea. So you can kind of cheat if you want.
You have to know that the big one is watching.
Right. And so in the middle of all of that, there was wind direction, there was strategy, there was current, there was all these different factors, how you're going to approach the mark, you know, and how you're going to get there first. Your start meant everything.
Well, those were always things that came out of the deepest part of your soul. You knew when it was time to tack, you knew when it was time to purl. And
you're right. There's an intuition to it. You have to kind of trust your gut, like your gut feeling about it's time right now. There was no real information there for you other than your gut.
It was a spiritual feeling, and that spirit told you what to do.
Oh, I like that. Maybe it was the sea herself. I remember you were the skipper for many years, and then at a certain point, you felt like your eyesight wasn't good enough, so I became the skipper. And I remember one of the rules I set up is that you had to have a joke to get on the boat. Like, we'd be at the dock, and it's like, you have to bring a joke. Because I liked maintaining a little levity. But we had good times together out at sea. I do remember that.
There is nothing like being at sea. Sea is another world, and that world rules you at sea. And you better be awake to the fact that it rules you, because you don't want to fall asleep at the wheel and find yourself buried in 20 feet of water that you can't escape from.
It was one of the biggest natural elements. And what went with it was navigation, and that was another interesting thing. I remember we did chart navigation, but you also learned celestial navigation. You used the stars. You had a little mechanism called a sextant, and you studied it, and you learned it had to do with using the stars to find your location, and it was used for centuries at sea.
Not everybody experiences life at sea. Life at sea is another life. It's a different life. It's a life that you have to be open to receive the message that's being sent to you. And it's hard sometimes to scrabble and figure out what it means. But it's possible, and you did a good job. I was proud of you.
Thank you, Dad.
It was a wonderful experience for me to know that I have a daughter that understands the ocean and the sea. Not everybody does.
Yeah, it's deep in there, Dad. It's still there. And it's one of my favorite things to do is to go to sea. I don't get a lot of chances to, but when I do, it makes me so happy.
Yeah, that's great. I'm glad. That makes me happy.
I remember a story you told about running away from home as a young boy. And I don't know that I ever heard why you ran away.
You know who I ran away with?
Well, that's what I wanted you to say. Who ran away with you?
A fellow named Boy. B-O-Y.
B-O-Y. Tell me about Boy.
Boy was a huge German shepherd. He was 4 feet tall, had four legs and a big tail. And he was very, very prominent in the landscape and wherever he was.
Well, what a good guy that he knew. I mean, you couldn't have been, what, 4 years old or something like that?
Yeah, about four.
Mm-hmm. And you lived in West Los Angeles, and you headed out. And what happened? I mean, here's a little boy walking on Olympic Boulevard or something, and there's this giant dog, and he just didn't leave your side. You crossed major streets, didn't you?
Oh, yeah, yeah. We went together, and they took one look at him, and he was this huge dog and this little kid. And boy, they all came to a stop. We stopped traffic on Olympic Boulevard, which was very busy, but we wanted to cross the street. We crossed the street.
And so ultimately, you guys ended up safe. I know that by looking at you, but did somebody help you or do you remember that part?
Yeah, a police officer did. He was very kind and he led us back, and Mom was out on the street looking for us, and she spotted us, and we got together, and that was that.
So boy was a hero.
Boy was the hero, is right. He's the one that kept everything under control.
You always had big dogs, and I wonder if that's because of your relationship with boy.
Well, of course, yeah.
So I remember many years ago, you were given a diagnosis of myasthenia gravis, and I didn't know what it was, but now I know that it's an autoimmune condition. That's a certain category of disorder. You were given that diagnosis, and it was maybe scary at first. I'm curious to know what your symptoms were and what you attribute your incredible longevity, and you've done so well given that diagnosis that's probably easily 30, if not 35, 40 years ago. What were your symptoms? What are your symptoms? And what has kept you so healthy this long? Like, what do you do to counter?
Well, it's funny because that's a good question. It made you weak.
Well, you definitely have a very positive and grateful attitude. I think those have to be contributors to you remaining so healthy despite having been given a diagnosis of myasthenia gravis in your 50s, I think.
No, I was a lot younger than 50. I was maybe 30. It was a diagnosis made by a human being. And I, being a human being, decided I would ignore that diagnosis and proceed with my life as I thought it should be. And I had a wonderful mom. She was the secret to my success entirely. And I was able to rescue myself, because there's only one person that can rescue you, and it's you.
That is the truth.
People are always wanting somebody else to save them, but it doesn't work that way.
I love listening to your dad philosophy.
Yeah, I'm glad that you know that, because I know that you'll do something with it and you'll pass it along and others will see it. That's what I'm really after, is passing it along to others, because it was saving my life. And saving my life, I want to save others.
Thank you. That's a good purpose. I love it. So I like your attitude about, okay, I was given this diagnosis, but I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to live to the fullest regardless. I'm not going to collapse around some idea of some storytelling. I'm just going to live my best life.
Every day I woke up, I said, this is the day I'm going to be successful, whatever I do. And I would go out there and I'd be positive. And I take whatever was given to me and be glad for it.
Well, you make the world a better place, in my opinion.
That's what I was trying to do, and I succeeded to a certain extent, and I appreciate the opportunity that God gave me.
You've taught me a lot of things. So one of the things that you did as an older adult is you took a horticulture class at the community college nearby, and you used to call it the farm. I remember you called it the farm, and you really got into it. You started growing vegetables. You had a buddy. You and Nick would go down to the community college, go down to the farm, and you learned the principles of farming and gardening, didn't you, about growing food?
I felt that it was enriching the life of the people on Earth by growing food. And I appreciated the Earth's offer of growing things. So I would plant things as much as I could, much as I had the opportunity. I would plant seeds to make things grow so that we could eat them and we could be better off as human beings. That's all I can say.
Well, that's enough, because now I'm enjoying it. You passed that along to me. So thank you, Dad.
Yeah, it's pretty simple, and it's really important. I'm glad that you grabbed hold of it, and you'll pass it on to somebody else.
Yeah, I'm working on it. Well, Dad, I just want to say that, you know, you've been a guiding light for me in my life. You've always been very loving and expressive and supportive as a father. And that's been so key to my own confidence as a woman in what is a patriarchal world. And so I just want to thank you for that.
Well, I think that's very nice. I'm glad that And that's probably the best achievement I could have. I didn't think of that, but it's probably the best achievement of all.
Well, I'm so grateful that you live near me. I get to see a lot of you, and I love you very much. So thanks for talking today, Dad. Is there any parting thoughts?
Parting thought is that keep up the good work. Keep it going. And intrigue those young ones around you to do some of these things.
With that, I'm going to say we could go on, but I'm going to say thank you. And will you come back again and talk to us again? Can I interview you again? Thanks for being here today.
My pleasure to be able to share life's experiences. I've not been asked by anybody else.
Yeah, you're not on the talk show circuit yet. Well, just wait until this comes out. Your phone's going to be ringing. Anyway, love you, Dad. I'll see you soon. Thank you for tuning in. If today's conversation inspired you, you can help us reach more people by sharing this episode with friends or leave a review. Be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. For additional resources, you can visit my website and stay connected with me on social media. A big thanks to the amazing team that makes this podcast possible, including Phil Svitek, Brianna Phipps, Leah Pellegrini, Melissa Walbridge, and Courtney Hamilton. When we all work together, we can create a world where positive change is not just possible, but inevitable. We'll be right back.